Support for the world's podcast comes from Partisan Records, presenting Azelle, the evocative new album from Bombino, a Tuareg musician whose guitar playing has been compared to the likes of Jimi Hendrix, and whose last album, Nomad, Rolling Stone named one of the 50 best of 2013. Azelle is available now on iTunes. For more, go to bombinomusic.com.
In China, there is no Panama. Today on the World. I'm Marco Werman. The Panama Papers have outed some of China's elite, including relatives of President Xi Jinping, and China's censors have been busy.
Of course, there's no mention in, like, the evening news. There's no mention on the home pages of major web portals and things like that.
Plus, a Mexican volcano called Popo is smoking, but for residents of Mexico City, just being able to see it through the smog means it's a good day.
Oh, wow, look at the mountains. You know, you can see Popo. I mean, so what if it's spewing some smoke?
And a campaign to keep Britain in the European Union one hug at a time.
I am now on Brit number 3. I've tried to hug my boss, and he just goes bright red every time, but I know I will get him eventually.
Those stories coming up today on The World. One thing that has not been talked about much in the whole Panama Papers scandal is who are Mossack and Fonseca, as in the guys behind Mossack Fonseca, the Panama-based law firm that helped a lot of wealthy people set up shell companies and offshore accounts where they could park their money and not pay taxes on it. Fonseca is Ramon Fonseca, a lawyer and former novelist, two-time winner of Panama's highest literary honor, in fact. Mossack is Jürgen Mossack, and Wall Street Journal reporter Cajal Vyas got the first interview with Mossack since the leak happened. Here's what Cajal got out of the conversation with Mr. Mossack.
He says they've done nothing wrong. When you ask him about the long list of names that have come out this week, he says, well, look, they're not our clients. His law firm works through financial intermediaries like banks or advisors who are in turn working with the ultimate beneficiaries. And so he says, look, all we do is sell these offshore shell companies, these offshore entities.
How can he honestly say he knew nothing or that his company knew nothing? I mean, there have been so many stories about how they've helped tyrants and fraudsters and narco traffickers.
Yeah, well, they say, look, they complied completely with local laws, and they do distance themselves using these intermediaries. They say that, you know, if a end user decides to change the use of, you know, says that they want to open this company for X reason and then ends up using it for a different reason, well, you know, look, we don't have any part in that. So they say, look, we're not doing anything wrong.
And when you spoke with him, how did he look? Did he seem comfortable? Did he seem nervous?
Yeah, he seemed actually quite confident. In fact, I mean, one thing that I would say kind of surprised me in our conversation was that, you know, he didn't really seem to have huge plans for changing his business model. In fact, he said, we're going to keep doing what we're doing or we've been doing for 40 years. When I asked him, you know, what changes he would make, I mean, he mentioned, you know, maybe better cybersecurity. you know, they say they want to be more selective with clients, maybe scale down on overseas franchises. Mossack Fonseca has dozens of offices around the world, which has franchised out. So they use Mossack Fonseca's name and logo. And they say, you know, some of the problems may have stemmed from there, but that's about it.
So you leave your hotel, you get in the taxi, and you tell them you want to go to the offices of Mossack Fonseca. What kind of reaction do you get from the taxi driver?
You get smiles. Surprisingly, what's interesting, that's actually a really great question. What's interesting is that, you know, it's a very small office. It's off a major strip along the financial district of downtown Panama. It's very easy to miss. It's a kind of a reflective glass, almost mirror-like exterior. I think it's about a 4 or 5 story building where they share space, and it's dwarfed by the towering skyscrapers that line a lot of the district. But yeah, what's interesting, I mean, obviously Mossack Fonseca is all over the news here and it's the hot topic. But what's interesting is that when you ask everybody from shopkeepers to taxi drivers about what they think of this, there's a lot of shrugging of the shoulders. People think that, you know, Panama is being scapegoated. It's being unfairly targeted, that what they're basically doing is no different than what, you know, major financial and economic powers around the world like the U.S. and the U.K. do.
Well, the president of Panama, Juan Carlos Varela, has defended his country's record on transparency, promised a review of regulations. What kind of shape will this law firm, Mossack Fonseca, be in a year from now?
Well, as of now, they don't seem to have too many plans of changing what they do. And so it's to be determined. I mean, Panamanian authorities have said that they will be launching an investigation, not only to Mossack Fonseca, but, you know, into the broader business in setting up offshore entities. But as of last night, when I spoke to Mr. Mossack and his aides, I mean, they had said that they had not even been contacted directly by Panamanian authorities. So it's still very much to be determined where this takes the company and the financial system here in Panama.
Kejo Vyas in Panama City for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
China is where you'll find more Mossack Fonseca offices than anywhere else in the world. And the Panama Papers have linked offshore shell companies to several of China's top leaders and to relatives of China's president, Xi Jinping. But if you were to search for Panama on the web today in China, you'll probably get this message. Sorry, searches for Panama came up with no relevant results. Censorship in China is nothing new, and the link to top Chinese leaders also didn't surprise Sarah Cook. She's the director of the China Media Bulletin at Freedom House.
What struck me was, first of all, that it's not only him, that basically among the people implicated are 8 current and former members of the Politburo Standing Committee. And then it's not only people that might be considered Xi's allies, but also several people who you might think of in terms of factional infighting as being his rivals. So it creates a situation where you've actually got quite a spectrum of people within the Communist Party, the higher echelons of the party, being implicated in this. And in a lot of ways, that's much more dangerous for them and much more sensitive for the party than if it was just a single official, even if that official were Xi Jinping.
Yeah, so what do the revelations in the Panama Papers actually do to amplify suspicions and rumors about corruption at the top of China's leadership?
I think what's so powerful about it is it essentially confirms a lot of the suspicions and fears that many people in China have. It also demonstrates not only that there might be corruption, because it's not clear that some of these gains are necessarily illegal, but also just that they're super, super rich. I mean, having these kinds of accounts and shell companies, that's not something that even, you know, you might say a millionaire would have, certainly not an ordinary citizen. But it's something that the super, super rich do. So basically, you have this implication that the highest echelons of the Communist Party and their families are that wealthy. And, you know, that doesn't sit so well either with ordinary people who, you know, are working day in and day out to try to earn some money, or with the lower echelons of the Communist Party, many of whom have been hit very hard by Xi's anti-corruption campaign. It just exposes some of the hypocrisy there and undermines the legitimacy of the party and of Xi Jinping himself.
Yeah, it exposes a hypocrisy if everybody knew about it. But as you well know, a lot of people don't know about the Panama Papers. Are China's censors just in overdrive at the moment?
Absolutely. I would say, you know, if you think about what my first thought was, it was, oh, well, this is interesting, but some of this we knew already. My second thought was, whoa, the censors are going to have quite a field day with this. So you definitely have this kind of cat and mouse game where the censors are in overdrive. Of course, there's no mention in like the evening news, which is still a key source of information for a lot of people. But I think the bigger battle is happening in the social media sphere, where, according to the BBC, within the first 24 hours of the news breaking, they had found that there were 480 conversation threads on the microblogging platform that had been deleted. And,
wow.
And that's just conversation threads. So it's really this cat and mouse game where people are trying to share the information, and particularly screenshots. So it's not just necessarily somebody putting in like a quick snippet of, there's this Panama Papers and Xi Jinping's implicated. A lot of times what people will do is they'll take a screenshot or some kind of photo of a news story from a Hong Kong paper, something translated into Chinese, and post that image. It's much harder for automated keyword searches to pick that up, and it's a way of conveying a lot more information to other readers. And that's what's been circulating a lot in social media inside China.
One more thing, Sarah. It's kind of weird. By putting their money in these offshore companies, it would seem that the Chinese leadership doesn't have faith in the institutions within China. What do you think they know that other Chinese don't?
I think that's part of what's very damning about this information getting out. Well, I think it's two things. One is a question of whether they have faith in the economic and financial stability of the country. And it's very hard to know what they really know about that that we wouldn't know. Though there are a lot of questions, and there's certainly a lot of censorship about the economy. But I think the other question is the political stability and this feeling of both, whether it's because of the anti-corruption campaign or because some kind of future change in the winds, whether it's under this regime or some kind of a shift after some kind of political upheaval, that they want to hedge their bets. And so they don't want to keep their money within China. They want to be able to be in a situation where if they need to escape, they can.
Sarah Cook directs the China Media Bulletin at Freedom House. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Thanks a lot for having me.
Speaking of corruption and fraud, Homeland Security investigators went to extraordinary lengths to uncover a visa fraud operation. They made up a fake college called the University of Northern New Jersey, complete with a working website, an actual building, and a logo. The goal was to nab a group of people specializing in fake U.S. student visas. Muzaffar Shishti told me how the feds managed to pull this one off. He directs the Migration Policy Institute at the New York University School of Law.
They created a website which looked like the website of a very established university. It had all the trappings that you would have of a regular university. People got attracted to it. There were Latin-sounding names for the motto. There were good pictures of the university. There was some semblance of curriculum being offered and a good educational experience. So people thought they were actually enrolling in a U.S. university, which would give them a U.S. brand to their degrees and which would make them more marketable in the homeland.
And these brokers who would get these visas to hand off to fake students, I mean, who's liable here? Who could be prosecuted?
Well, technically, any set of people are liable. There are clearly people who were offering the enticements, which would be the smugglers. There were people who might have facilitated the production of documents, which created the feeling that this was an appropriate regular university. And there may have been some students also who participated in the fraud, but I think you'll have to, frankly, have much difficult time establishing their intent for having participated in the fraud.
I mean, just to be clear, I mean, these so-called students didn't go to classes or any school. They just wanted to stay in the U.S., correct?
Yes, or just got a degree. I mean, there was a much larger scandal exposed in Pakistan last year, where a large number of people were enrolling both in a domestic program, an international program, which was not driven by the need to get a visa, which is just driven by the need to get a degree. You know, I think you have to note that this has come in the wake of two things. One is that there's huge premium for getting a European or U.S. degrees in the labor market in a lot of the developing countries. And second is that online operations have now become an integral part of the operations of pretty reputable universities. So it's easier for students to actually believe that this might be a regular academic program.
Yeah. Have U.S. authorities done this kind of thing before, actually setting up a university with a building and everything just to catch the bad guys?
Yes, I haven't seen this kind of a model before, but I think they must have gotten this idea from the interviews they did with students they were able to prosecute in the context of the of a university in California last year, which must have given them good leads to say that an operation of like this will yield good law enforcement results.
It's amazing that some of these so-called students managed to find work at places like Facebook and Apple and the U.S. Army. How is that even possible? Did they have higher education from somewhere else?
Well, either we'll have to know the facts. Either they had higher education degrees from somewhere else, or those employers were not that careful in ascertaining whether this was a legitimate university or not.
What do you think will happen to these students?
Unfortunately, you know, the students are the victims in this case, and you could say they'll become double victims, which is the tragedy here, is that they were duped by these brokers into paying high fees to a non-existent university, and now they will face removal proceedings from the United States. And, you know, that's the sad outcome of these tragic stories.
Muzaffar Shishti, director of the Migration Policy Institute at NYU School of Law. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Arms open wide. We're coming in for Hug a Brit Day. That story later here on The World. All mosquitoes are not created equal, and that is a big, big deal when it comes to combating Zika. because the virus, which continues to raise fears about babies with microcephaly throughout Latin America, the virus is spread by mosquitoes, and researchers have long focused attention on one species of mosquito in particular.
It has these long black and white legs. And literally, I've been walking around favelas with people where someone will spot one and people freak out. You know, it's like, oh, there's a black and white. There it is. There's the black and white. Kill the black and white. People will literally like run down the street away from it.
Will Carlos reports for our Global Post team out of Rio de Janeiro. He was describing the Aedes aegypti mosquito, the species that the World Health Organization says is spreading Zika with every bite. But Will tells me that's never actually been proven.
No one has actually ever found any mosquito or actually captured a mosquito in Brazil carrying the Zika virus. So they don't actually know for sure whether it's being carried in Brazil by Aedes aegypti or by some other type of critter or some other type of mosquito.
And tell us why it is so important to know which mosquito species is actually transmitting Zika.
Anyone who's spent time in the tropics knows that people are kind of scared of these spooky black and white mosquitoes. I mean, you go into the favelas here and people will say, you know, you've got to watch out for the black and whites. And it was the same. I lived in Indonesia for a couple of years. Same thing. You know, you watch out for the black and white mosquitoes because they're the ones that are known to carry dengue, to carry chikungunya. They're the bad guys. They crucially bite during the day. So in Brazil, for example, a lot of people cover themselves with mosquito repellent through the day. They'll reapply through the day if they can afford it. And at night, they kind of chill out. They relax. You know, once the sun goes down, they don't sleep under mosquito nets. They don't cover themselves up. They don't put the mosquito repellent on. And the crazy thing here is that it could be that the mosquitoes that bite at night, of which there are plenty and many different species, are the ones that are actually carrying the Zika virus.
So how are Zika researchers in Brazil trying to solve this puzzle definitively?
The sort of holy grail is to capture one of these mosquitoes. And the difficult thing is that only about 1 in every 1,000 to 3 in every 1,000 of these mosquitoes is thought to be carrying this virus. So what they have to do is they have to actually capture a live mosquito, which they do by sort of going around people's houses with these machines that look basically like big vacuum cleaners. They suck in the mosquitoes and then they have to very quickly, they have to freeze them and then they have to test them. And the thing is that it's very expensive to test these mosquitoes. So there's only a few people doing it in Brazil. But what they'll do is they'll go in, they'll dissect the mosquito, and then they'll perform various tests on it to establish whether or not that particular mosquito was carrying blood infected with the Zika virus.
How much more differently does Aedes aegypti actually behave from most other mosquitoes?
Well, this is the crucial point. Aedes aegypti behaves very differently to other mosquitoes. And it's really distinctive. You know, I can probably count on one hand the number of times that I've sort of swatted an Aedes aegypti, either in my house or sort of out on the street in Brazil. I swat the other types of mosquitoes, which are primarily this mosquito called Culex, which are very, very common and they're everywhere. And you swat them all the time. So the Culex mosquitoes bite at night. At dawn and dusk mainly, and then also during the first few hours of darkness, whereas the Aedes is active during the day. So, I mean, the Brazilian government is going out, it's spending hundreds of millions of dollars on this huge education campaign to tell people to cover up during the day and to watch out for black and white mosquitoes. And the fact that they don't actually know that it is those mosquitoes, at least in Brazil, that's carrying this virus, is what makes that so perplexing.
Will Carlos with our Global Post team in Rio. Thanks very much for the update, Will.
Thank you.
Okay, who needs a hug? I hear the British do, even though they have this reputation for not being all touchy-feely. But this June, a referendum is planned in Britain to decide if the country should stay in the European Union or exit the EU, the British exit, or Brexit. British voters will decide, and some 2 million citizens of other EU countries who live in the UK can't do anything about it. So a group called Please Don't Go UK is encouraging foreigners in Britain to put their arms around the nearest local and then post a picture on Instagram with the hashtag HugABrit. Christine Ullmann is German and lives in London. Is the idea that if you show the Brits enough love, they'll stay in the EU?
I think the idea is overall to just show that this is about people. A lot about the EU is about faceless institutions and people are angry about issues. But ultimately, the ones who profit from the EU and the ones who have the most to lose are individuals. And I have lived in this country for 6 years now, and I feel at home here, and I love my British neighbors, and I know most of them love me. And we wanted to show that this is all about the love. This is all about unity. And us individuals, we need to stick together.
Yeah, but aren't Brits famously averse to being touched and especially hugged? They cherish that personal space. Do you hug your neighbors?
It's an interesting one. When you first raise the issue, you get very embarrassed. Oh, really? You hug? And when you explain, we don't just run up to random strangers, squeeze them real tight from behind and run away again. This is a voluntary. We express our love. And if you want to love us back, go for it. Then they love being hugged. So I think it's all about the way you approach them and to show them, you know what, this isn't like an invasion of personal space. This is an offer. Come to me and you can get a hug.
So for this campaign, have you hugged a Brit yet?
I have, yes.
How many?
I cheated with the first one. That was my husband.
Okay.
That was an easy way in. That's a Brit who knows how to be hugged by me. I am now on Brit number three. I've tried to hug my boss, and he just goes bright red every time, but I know I will get him eventually.
And I gather you had a celebrity hug as well on those three hugs. Who was it?
Yes, I was really lucky to meet Jarvis Cocker of The Pulp.
Oh, the singer. So you're the one. The Guardian reported that Jarvis Cocker got a hug. So you're the one who hugged Jarvis.
I'm the one who hugged Jarvis, yes. And he's actually a youth hero of mine. I mean, I'm a Gen Xer. So for me, meeting Jarvis Cocker was amazing, and getting a hug and supportive words. Like, obviously, we told him why I'm looking to hug him, why we're taking pictures of it. So he was totally on board, which was amazing.
That's cool. And just to make this personal, how would a Brexit, if the UK leaves the EU, how would that impact you?
For me, first and foremost, it would be a huge signal that Britain doesn't want to be part of a bigger whole, and in some way almost rejects its Europeanness. So it would be a real moment of sadness.
So do you think this campaign can actually work?
Yes, I really do. Like, I also manage two of our social media presences, and we've had such amazing feedback, such positiveness from people who said, this is just what we needed through all this nastiness in the campaign. Somebody to just say, hey, let's be positive and let's highlight the things we love rather than all the bad things. So I think that there's a lot of goodwill, and all it took was a lightning rod to come through.
Christine Ullmann is a German who lives in London. Big hugs to you, Christine. Thanks very much.
And to you. Thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Some chefs in France are rethinking French cuisine, starting with the main dish.
I think the main thing is to think first about the vegetable and to add some meat or fish on the side.
And let nothing go to waste. That story plus musicians in Haiti travel back in time to keep things real in the present. Still ahead here on The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is committed to helping those who do good do well. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. I hope you are hungry, because for the next few minutes, we're going to be talking food. Coming up, Vermont leads the way when it comes to labeling genetically modified foods. That's from our food policy department. But first, let's go gourmet. The French, as you know, are very attached to their food. So is a lot of the rest of the world. French cuisine is widely seen as among the highest forms of the art of cooking. And you don't mess with success, right? Well, these days, some leading French chefs are messing with success because climate change. Here's reporter Adeline Sia in Paris.
François Pastot has run his small gourmet restaurant, L'Epis du Pain, in Paris for 20 years. I met him in his kitchen as he was stirring a fragrant soup.
So that will be the soup of the day, the sea scallop soup.
This sea scallop soup, served with a swirl of savory chestnut mousse, is a sweet and salty treat. But here's the thing. It's made with scraps left over from the preparation of Pastot's sea scallop main dish. In this kitchen, nothing gets wasted. Shrimp shells are boiled for broth. Apple cores are turned into applesauce. And when it comes to duck,
we use all the parts of the duck.
Pasteur says the neck can be served stuffed, scraps of meat can be used for terrines, and bones can be roasted with vegetables to make a delicious caramelized sauce. Putting all good ingredients to use is part of Pasteur's mission as a chef. And as the president of the Restaurant and Food Industry Association, Bon pour le Climat, or Good for the Climate. The group's philosophy is simple. Educate the French about climate-friendly cuisine, and making sure there's no waste is just the beginning. It also means giving priority to vegetables and plant proteins over animal proteins, which have a much bigger carbon footprint. But Pasteur says that will mean a cultural shift in France.
When we think about a meal, we always think about the meat and what we can put on the side with vegetables. I think the main thing is to think first about the vegetable and to add some meat or fish on the side.
When it comes to fish, Pasteur says he only uses healthy fish stocks, so no more red tuna or swordfish, for example. Also, no more trucked in mineral water. Instead, tap water is microfiltered on site, and at the end of the day, the vegetable trash is hauled off to be turned into biofuel. Pasteur says each meal is an opportunity to effect change. But the customers don't pack l'épée du pain for the lessons.
Alors là, nous dégustons un magret de canard.
Isabelle Demeure is having duck magret with braised cabbage, walnuts, dried apricots, and the parsnips puree. She's a regular here.
Ici, c'est un restaurant où on suit vraiment les saisons.
They really follow the seasons here, Demeure says, and there's a real original take. You feel that they pay attention to the provenance of the products, to French high standards, all attributes of a quality table. Just a few metro stations away from L'Épée du Pain, the renowned upscale restaurant Lucas Carton has been setting a quality table since the 1800s at prices starting at $150 for lunch. But even in this iconic institution, head chef Julien Dumas is making big changes. On the menu du jour...
Et là, aujourd'hui, il y a la dorade et d'huître.
Today there is bream and oysters. For the entree, pollock and buckwheat. Buckwheat normally comes from Russia, but this one is grown in Auvergne. Then we have peanuts from Bordeaux and yuzu from Perpignan.
For Dumas, the key to responding to the Earth's needs and changing climate is stay local and know your food, including the people who produce it. At 36, Dumas is young to have attained his prestigious post, but he's not shy about shaking things up.
J'ai pas de viande rouge du tout, j'ai pas de bœuf.
I have no red meat at all. No beef, so that's easy.
Instead, Dumas serves up more seafood, which can have a smaller carbon footprint. But it doesn't always. That's why he also got rid of out-of-season lobster and a beloved dish with crayfish from Scotland, too far away. Dumas even took a step verging on heresy. He got rid of a classic dish served here for 40 years, canard apicius. That is marinated duck breast served with a concoction of tart apples and dates.
Il y en a qui se plaignent parce que j'ai retiré un canard.
Some complain that I took out the duck dish, but those ducks were mistreated, and the dish called for apples from Chile. I prefer to wait for apple season.
The chefs behind Bon pour le Climat say there's no contradiction between protecting the climate and maintaining, even enhancing, the art of cooking and the pleasure of eating. And while they've raised some eyebrows, they feel they're following changes in France as much as leading. But Chef Dumas of Lucas Carton says there is another reason he's putting so much effort into changing French cuisine.
Moi, j'ai deux enfants.
I have two kids, and I'd like to leave them a clean earth.
For the world, Adeline Cyr, Paris.
Tomorrow, Adeline visits a more downscale Paris restaurant, which serves up food that would otherwise have gone to waste. Back to the U.S. now, where change of a different kind is coming to our food industry. Starting this summer, you might see a new label on some foods at your grocery store, produced with genetic engineering. If you're wondering whether you missed an announcement from the FDA or maybe a bill passing Congress, nope, you didn't, because a change across the country is due to a law passed in one small state, Vermont. The world's Carolyn Beeler has our story.
A lot of hanging baskets, and we sell a lot of ornamentals.
I met anti-GMO activist Will Allen last week in a greenhouse on the organic farm he manages in central Vermont.
We do almost 100 vegetables every year, everything from artichokes to zucchini.
Alan wears a white beard and a Patagonia coat and reminds me of a svelte hippie Santa. He leads me by the farm stand he stocks with those veggies in the summer, past some chickens and onto a back farm field.
Our goal in this has been like to create a local production for local use organic farm. That was like a destination, a valuable place to demonstrate how important a local farm was to the local community.
Alan doesn't like genetically modified crops, or GMOs, because they go against his vision of a local organic food system. One reason why is that many GMO crops are designed to be herbicide resistant. That lets farmers spray increasingly toxic and persistent chemicals on fields. And Alan worries they'll work their way into the soil and crops of farmers who don't use them. So he's worked along with the coalition of activists to get a law passed in Vermont that would require foods containing GMOs to be labeled.
We were able to get 2,500 letters, phone calls, and emails sent to each legislator in the House and Senate. And that kind of message was powerful.
The effort ultimately won over even skeptical Vermont legislators like Senator Bobby Starr.
I never really did find anything wrong about GMOs. But then as time went on, people started asking, well, why shouldn't we have the right to know?
The law passed in 2014 and will go into effect this July. Now, that's all well and good for Vermont, but how did we get from there to here?
Campbell Soup is the first major food company to start disclosing the presence of genetically modified ingredients.
Candy maker Mars joins a small group of U.S. food companies adding labels to products that contain GMOs.
General Mills says it will label all of its products in the U.S. that contain genetically modified ingredients.
As you heard, many big U.S. food companies now say they'll add a label to all of their GMO-containing products, all across the country. Here's how it happened. Food companies tried and failed to block the Vermont law, then a law that would override state-based GMO labeling stalled in D.C. Now, many food manufacturers say it's just too costly to label food destined for just one tiny state. So they'll label all GMO products nationwide. Those labels would be slapped on a huge variety of packaged foods because most of the corn and soy grown in the U.S. is genetically engineered. All right, so big deal. It's just a label, right? But here's the thing. GMO supporters fear the labels will cause consumers to shun the products, and they have good reason to worry.
There's very little on offer in terms of products containing GMOs in Europe.
That's Natalie Mole with the European Biotech Trade Association, Europa Bio. The European Union began requiring GMO labels roughly a decade ago, and Mole says that essentially shoved GMO products out of the market.
The labeling law has meant that a lot of food companies have decided to source non-GMs.
GMO supporters say the problem is that requiring labels gives GMO food a bad reputation without reason. The World Health Organization, the American Medical Association, and the American Association for the Advancement of Science all say there's no evidence genetically engineered foods are unsafe to eat. Some development experts go even further. They believe GMOs are vital to fighting global hunger and can even be good for the environment. Back in the U.S., the Grocery Manufacturers Association is suing Vermont to stop the law from taking effect, but for now, companies are hustling to comply by the July 1st deadline. Vermont's Attorney General William Sorrell says his office has been flooded with questions.
We sell bottled water. Do we have to label that? And do you have the necessary message in Spanish for us? And whatever. We're getting a lot of interesting questions.
The law is complicated. Still, Sorrell seems happy to enforce it.
I'm proud of the fact that Vermont, this small state, is leading the country.
States, he says, are the laboratories of democracy, even if it's not quite clear where this particular experiment will lead. For The World, Carolyn Beeler, Montpelier, Vermont.
Let's return to where we started today, the fallout from the Panama Papers data leak. First political casualty, the Prime Minister of Iceland, who, along with his wife, had parked a large sum of money in an offshore shell company. That revelation sent thousands of Icelanders into the streets of Reykjavik. The Prime Minister resigned, but many Icelanders are still unhappy. Birgitta Jonsdottir is a poet and activist who leads the Pirate Party. That is the name. The Pirate Party holds only 3 seats in Iceland's parliament, but in recent weeks has gained a lot of popular support. Birgitta, thanks for being with us. A lot of Icelanders want a whole new election now. What does the Pirate Party want?
Well, we also want new elections because we feel that there's been a total breach of confidence in the government. Just want to clarify one thing. The Pirate Party has actually been leading in the polls for the last half a year or longer. And so the sad thing for the government is that the tiniest party in the parliament has been more popular than them for a whole year. And yet they are two parties, and the two traditional parties that have been in power in Iceland for almost all the time since we got our independence in 45.
Yeah. Sum up for us what the Pirate Party actually stands for. Like, if you have a mission statement, what is it?
Well, mission statement is 21st century legislation, sort of moving legislation of the digital era into the human rights era from the last century. And we originally founded around the principle of creating a safe haven in Iceland for freedom of information and expression and digital privacy and copyright reform and, of course, direct democracy.
It sounds like the Panama Papers scandal kind of falls right in the Pirate Party's sweet spot.
Actually, one of the things we focused a lot on is to create a digital safe haven for this type of activity, protects and encourages investigative journalism, and to change laws so that those that host data like this can host it without threats of having to remove it. So this is like, a Pirate Party policy in action.
Why call it the Pirate Party, by the way? I mean, isn't there a negative connotation there with pirates who steal money?
Well, pirates were also semi-Robin Hoods in some instances. But the reason why it's called that, it's a part of an international movement of people that have been fighting for digital rights. Icelanders traditionally don't like pirates. We were attacked by pirates in the old days. But just the way the Pirate Party has in Iceland has developed with this name, they see it as a sort of a defiance as well. So it's actually transformed into a positive, which often happens with words.
You know, Icelanders must be pretty cynical. This Panama Papers stuff, the 2008 banking crisis began in Reykjavik. What do you want to see Iceland become? I mean, as a political leader?
We had a massive financial crisis in 2008. People realized in the wake of the crisis that everything they put their faith in had failed them. There was a big soul searching. And through a discussion of, you know, who we are, there was a new constitution written in the most crowdsourced fashion of any other constitution in the world. And the constitution was then put to a national referendum. And people said, yes, we want this as the basis for our new constitution. And unfortunately, it was not implemented before the last government finished their job. So the Pirate Party is very keen on implementing this new constitution, because what we've been witnessing in the last few days is that neither the minority or the people of Iceland have any tools to hold those that are in power accountable, except to gather outside the parliament and hope that the leaders will listen to them.
Birgitta Jonsdottir is the head of Iceland's up-and-coming Pirate Party. Thank you very much for being with us.
Pleasure.
By the way, Iceland's prime minister isn't the only casualty of the Panama Papers. We've actually been keeping a running list here in the newsroom. It includes an ethics official at World Soccer Body FIFA and the head of a prominent transparency organization in Chile, now with even more transparency. Not to mention the entire country of Panama and its tax haven laws now under scrutiny. We have the full list up on our Facebook page. Just look for PRI's The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. This has been a terrible week for people in Mexico City, and I mean everybody. That's because the city is experiencing the worst air pollution in over a decade. The World's Monica Campbell is there. Monica, you live in Mexico City. When you look out across the city, what are you seeing?
You know, it looks like it's going to rain, but it's not. And so it's this sort of heavy, jaundiced yellow hanging over the city. I mean, it looks like it should be about to pour, but it's just this heavy smog. People here call it cream, the nata. You know, when you come in above in a plane into Mexico City, sometimes you're just like, what am I doing? Like, you can just feel the dust in your body. And my nose is, I don't know if you can even hear it, but it's
you sound stuffed up.
I sound congested. There's a cough. And you hear it all over the city. Everyone's got that rattle.
I gather city officials have been giving out all kinds of advice on how people should deal with this problem.
on the official level, there have been, you know, directives to schools to not have kids play outdoors. So you basically have a lot of people staying indoors. The authorities here ordered 2 out of every 5 private vehicles to stay off the road as long as the city's ozone layer is measuring at emergency levels. The city's also ordered industrial plants to reduce their emissions considerably. Trucks, you know, you have these big trucks that come into the city. They're being barred from entering the city, so you have big backups. It's kind of a mess.
You know, recently you and I had been talking about the last time I was in Mexico City, 97 or 98, and how I had real trouble breathing with the pollution at that time. And you said, oh, yeah, everyone knows those were really bad years for pollution. I mean, it sounds like people in Mexico City just have this kind of folklore around air pollution.
Yeah, people have lived through this before. I mean, they know the bad old days, you know, in the early 90s when Mexico City was considered one of the most polluted cities in the world. The feeling is that Mexico City had sort of nipped this in the bud by changing the rules when it came to when cars could circulate, by upgrading its bus system and working with industry to reduce emissions. But now we're starting to see that this is a car culture. This is a city that depends heavily on cars. Mm. And at the same time, you've had massive amounts of cash put into building bigger highways here. It's also a country that produces a lot of cars. So are you really going to have a country trying to discourage people from buying cars when it is one of the more thriving parts of the economy? So there are a lot of two minds about this. But sure, it's something people live with. And the real problem is that you have high asthma levels. If your kids have respiratory problems, you know, this is not in the long term a great place to be if you're having that type of issue.
What about the volcano? Is that affecting anything?
Right. The beloved Popo volcano. Yeah, it's been spewing its smoke. But in a way, when you're able to see the volcano, when you're able to see the mountains around Mexico City, it's a good day, right?
Right.
I mean, that's sort of how your average Mexican feels good about living in Mexico City is when they can go, oh, wow, look at the mountains. You know, you can see Popo. I mean, so what if it's spewing some smoke? It's beautiful to see. And you know, you could actually see that far. I mean, right now, there is no way you're going to be able to see Popo or the mountains that ring Mexico City today. I mean, I can see a couple of the skyscrapers, but beyond that, nothing. It's a good day when you can see the volcano.
The world's Monica Campbell in Mexico City, a city that is struggling with air quality. Thank you and stay healthy.
Thanks, Marco.
Finally today, Haiti is still struggling more than 6 years after that devastating earthquake back in 2010. But I want to tell you now about something positive that came out of that tragedy. This is the ensemble La Cou Musique. They came together from various parts of Haiti right after the earthquake. Their name? Well, a little Haitian Creole lesson is in order now. Musique is pretty easy. It means music. And La Cou, that's a little more complicated. Here's lead singer and guitarist with the band, Steve Valcourt, to explain the three meanings of La Cou.
The first one is La Cou means yard. In your yard, it's like where you feel comfortable. And then La Cou back in my country is when you have your La Cou. It's like when all your ancestors, all your family, your grandparents been through there. So it's a place of where you can call home. And then spiritually, La Cou, it's like when you want to talk to spirit, like when it's your La Cou sense, you can go there, find peace in your mind, find everything. So where you have to really be you.
This tune, Wadiyo, the title track of their new CD, could be something of a motto for La Cou Musique. It means, you tell them, we're still here. We, being Haitians generally after the earthquake, but especially the Haitians who feel a connection to the country's old traditions and customs. A lot of people said the 2010 earthquake in Haiti was a moment to reinvent the country. Culturally, though, reinventing Haiti was not something the musicians in La Cou Musique were interested in. Even before the quake, Steve Valcourt says artists like them were already dealing with
globalization, like everyone is trying to be futurist, if I can call it like that. Everything trying to put new stuff, coming with technology, coming everything. So we have that tendency of losing the roots.
And that became the motivating factor for Steve and the 8 other members of La Cou Musique.
It was not a group. First of all, it was a project to put the ancient songs, like keep them alive, because we figure that from 2-3 generations from now, everything we know from where we come from, because all the music that's coming, all the international stuff that we having every day, which is good, we improving, but we probably in a certain way down the road, we're going to forget how we used to be.
Lakou Musique have dug deep into Haiti's traditional songbook, as well as reproducing traditional instruments. The tambour, for example, one of the drums they use.
How we make the tambour is not a newish tambour, it's a really antique way.
Kind of more in line with how Africa built it?
Yes, kind of, but like we said, we all come from that roots in Africa, but even in Africa, some place we don't play that type of tambour and that type of rhythm. So that's how far we want to go to get that roots and mix it with however the new generation can bring up to it. Like when you say rap and hip-hop, yes, we love it and it goes into the new generation, but let's not forget where everything starts.
And while Lakou Musique digs into the past, they produce something that sounds very now for Haiti. That's Pose, a track from the just-released CD by Haiti's Lakou Musique. We've got more from Lakou Musique up on our website. One of my favorites is a video of them singing a song called Badazile on a subway car in New York City. I guarantee you'll be smiling by the end of it. Just head on over to PRI.org. Marco Werman here, coming to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.